Welcome to all the participants to today's teleclass on resilience with Dr. Robert Brooks. As Laurel mentioned, I'm Dr. Beth Frades. I'm a certified wellness coach, and I'm on the board of advisors for the health and wellness coaching section of the Institute of Coaching. We're delighted to have Dr. Robert Brooks with us today. He's a clinical psychologist. He's on the faculty of Harvard Medical School, and he served as director of the Department of Psychology at McLean Hospital. Dr. Brooks is author or co-author of 15 books, including The Power of Resilience, Achieving Balance, Confidence, and Personal Strength in Your Life, The Self-Esteem Teacher, Raising Resilient Children, and The Charismatic Advisor. Our class today is titled Creating Resilient Mindsets and Motivating Environments. Dr. Brooks proposed that we conduct the class more like an interview rather than a lecture, so I'll be asking Dr. Brooks questions, and we'll be sure to leave time for questions from participants toward the end of the hour. The class itself will last 1.5 hours, and in that time, we hope to cover 4 main objectives. Learn the main components of intrinsic motivation as one. Secondly, understand the concept of mindset. 3, identify characteristics of resilient mindset. And finally, learn specific strategies to reinforce resilient mindsets in your clients. So, Dr. Brooks, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And let's dive right into some questions. How's that sound?
It sounds great.
Okay. So, you're going to be addressing several key concepts as I just described in this teleclass. Mindsets, motivating environments, resilience, especially as they relate to the role of coaching.
Mm-hmm.
So, could you begin by describing the concept of mindsets and its relevance for coaches?
Yeah, the concept of mindsets actually has a long history, which I don't have time to go well into today, but it's a key concept for coaches. And not to simplify too much, but a definition I use in all of my work, I say mindsets are assumptions and expectations that we possess about ourselves and others that guide our behavior. And I'll just mention what I mean, that we all have assumptions and expectations about who we are as people, how competent we are, and whether we realize it or not, we make certain assumptions and have expectations for other people. And as coaches, we should be very aware of our own expectations as well as those of our clients. So just to give a few examples so it's more alive, is like one theory that I have been fascinated by, given my interest in resilience, is what they call self-efficacy theory. And simply put, that theory says that when you face a task or challenge, that how confident you feel about succeeding at that task or challenge may play a large role in how successful you will be, as most of us know. I mean, I saw it even with kids when I coached my sons in basketball league. If a child went to the foul line to take a foul shot and was very optimistic about making it, they were going to be able to make it more often than not. If a child went to the foul line and his or her mindset was, I stink at foul shooting, I'll never make it, more often than not, they would not make it. So I became just very fascinated how people approached the task and whether or not they were successful. So to give you now examples from actual coaching that I did, I was consulting with a manager in a biotech firm who had just been actually promoted, and he was going to be running his first staff meetings. And he said to me that he had never run meetings. He'd attended many, but never run meetings, and was really very, very anxious about it. And I sat in on one of the first meetings, and his anxiety was very apparent. He cut people off. He wasn't certain what to say. And, of course, everyone in the meeting could sense that anxiety, and the meeting did not go very well. And he and I spent a lot of time in terms of his mindset about running meetings, but also specific strategies. Another example of a mindset and how it impacted in the workplace, I'll call him Mr. Butler because that's what I call him in one of my books. I saw a man in his late 30s who had started his own biotech firm, and he came to see me, not that he really wanted to, but his primary care physician felt he should. Anyway, he came to see me because he was having difficulty, he was losing staff members and whatever. And he said to me, right away he said that he had read a lot of books about leadership and that how you had to delegate authority to people. And he said, I'll give you an example, Dr. Brooks. And he said, we had a new project coming in, and I met with my managers, and I said, by next week, come up with some ideas for this new project. And he then turned to me and he said, isn't this good leadership, you know, that I was delegating responsibility? And I said, yeah, it sounds good, but there was this hesitancy in me. And I said, so what happened? He said, well, they came back the next week, and I thought they were some of, I couldn't believe this. He said, I thought they were some of the dumbest ideas I ever heard. So I then asked him, well, let me ask you, how did you respond? And he responded, he said, I tend to be a very direct person. I told them these are some of the dumbest ideas I've heard. And I first, Beth, I thought he was kidding. But then I realized he was not kidding at all. And then when I asked him, because I was trying to get his mindset, I said, well, what do you make of all this? He said to me, I guess I didn't hire a good staff. They just don't get it. So his mindset was he was doing everything right, but his staff didn't get it. And he kept all the time, what did he say? My staff just doesn't get it. And he actually said to me, maybe you shouldn't be working with me. Maybe you should be helping my staff learn to get it. So his mindset was really interfering with the success of his firm because he kept looking for them to change. And as I'll talk about later, he had to start to learn that his particular mindset of blaming others and not looking at responsibility he could take interfered with things. A woman I was seeing who was coaching, she had an attitude, and part of it came from her own upbringing. She had an attitude that if people in her department did what was expected and right, then she didn't have to say anything. That was what their job was. But if they did something wrong, she had to really say something. So her mindset was you don't give that much positive feedback, but instead you let people know when they've done something wrong, which goes against almost every theory of motivation. And work with her, what also came up is she grew up in a home where that was taught, and she could actually start saying she never liked it that way. So anyway, a person's mindset about what motivates people or how you it really can engage people is something that certainly a coach has to understand, because part of being a coach, I think, is to change those negative mindsets and the practices that follow into more positive mindsets.
Right. That's really helpful, your specific examples with Mr. Butler and these mindsets that were certainly not resilient mindsets. And that is one of the words that defines Dr. Brooks, in my mind at any rate, and many people who are your followers, resiliency and resilient mindsets. So you've actually expanded on the meaning of resilience in your work and research and studies. So if you could help us understand your definition of resilience, and then we can put resilience together with a mindset, that would be great.
Certainly. I mean, this is probably the passion of my career. You know, when I was first trained as a psychologist, you know, I mainly looked at what people couldn't do or what they did wrong. And then I started becoming much more interested in what helps people to lead more fulfilling, successful lives. So just to give a little background, because the way I use resilience is somewhat different than some of the researchers have. When the term first started to be used, it basically, meant that the ability to bounce back from adversity, the ability to cope more effectively with the challenges that you face. Much of the initial research, Beth, was based on studying individuals who had really confronted adversity and been more successful. That included people who had been abused or neglected when they grew up. That included people who grew up in war zones. That included people who unfortunately grew up in a home where one of the parents had a serious psychiatric illness and there was a lot of chaos. And we learned a great deal because mental health professionals started saying, why do some people growing up in homes like these or having these kinds of experiences, why as adults are some doing much better in life than others? You know, why do some have good relationships, very good jobs, while others seem to be not very successful? So we started to learn a lot, which I will get into, that the characteristics of people who are more resilient, who could bounce back. And this is very important for coaches to know because it's going to impact on their work to help clients be more resilient and to help their clients help others be more resilient. But one of the things that came up is, as I started to give some talks about resilience, I had a very interesting response. And I want to let people know this because it was to really change my view. One was I was giving a talk on raising resilient children, and a parent called me and wondered if she should attend the talk because she said her kids are, you know, are doing well in life and they're very happy and they come from loving homes, so would it be relevant to them? And then I was speaking actually at a luncheon. There were some business people there. And before I spoke, some said, is the topic really relevant for them because, their organizations are running smoothly and their workers, you know, the employees are doing well. And I realized at that time that people were mainly thinking of resilience as applying only to those people or organizations that were having a great deal of difficulty. And even though that is how researchers saw it, I started saying the following. From studying people who have undergone great adversity and handle things relatively well, we have learned that there are certain characteristics in those people and a certain outlook that they have, what I call a resilient mindset, that those who are not resilient, those who feel more defeated, those who feel more like victims do not possess. And then I started saying, well, why can't we take those characteristics that we know are associated with people who are resilient, and why can't we apply it to anyone, whether they have faced great adversity or not? And I realize researchers would not necessarily see it this way, but as someone doing clinical work and coaching, I really felt what we learned from these, what I'll call at-risk populations, we could apply to any population. And so I started saying, let's look at these characteristics and can I apply it in my work? And then other people at the University of Pennsylvania, well, Martin Seligman, who's done a lot of work, of course, in positive psychology, some of them had the same view, that they actually started saying, we want people to be resilient not only to bounce back from adversity, but because being resilient will help them to lead more satisfying, successful lives. So basically, I expanded it to apply only to those individuals who have had difficulty in life, to all individuals. And the other issue I realized, and we all realize, is any one of us at any time, we could be, you know, have been leading a very successful life, and then suddenly, very suddenly, things can happen in our life that really test our abilities to cope. Whether one loses a job or a divorce or a significant loss in the family, and we all at some points are going to face challenges, some more than others. So in another way, when I expanded the concept of resilience, I also looked at it in terms of being proactive and almost a prevention model rather than being reactive, but be proactive, help people have those skills that will provide them with really the ability to deal with adversity as different adversities and challenges arose. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, it's wonderful that you've done that, and I'm wondering if you can take this opportunity to actually identify those characteristics of a resilient mindset, specifically what is it look like, a resilient mindset?
Right, and as I go over this, I hope all of the people listening say, well, this makes really sense, because I think mm-hmm. what I'm going to be describing is not something way off in the star somewhere that are only for, you know, a few people, but that it seems to make sense. So I also feel that the characteristics I'm going to describe are things that coaches, just part of their job, focus on all the time, or people, you know, in healthcare positions. It's what they should focus on. So as I go over some of these, and please, you know, feel free to come in, I think that people will see, hey, this really does go along with being a coach. This really goes along with helping people to lead more satisfying lives. So, you know, there are several things. In my books, I often talk about 8 or 9 characteristics. I'll go over some of the key ones here. One of the main ones is that resilient people, and this shouldn't surprise anyone, feel that problems are there to be solved rather than be burdened by. And what I mean by this is that we are all going to face problems. And some people, when they face problems, their mindset immediately is, oh my, another burden, another struggle, whatever. A resilient person feels that he or she possesses the ability to solve problems and make decisions so that problems are seen as opportunities. And so to give an example, when a resilient person faces a problem, their mindset is already engaged in the following thinking. Okay, here's this problem. What other experiences have I had in the past to solve this problem or similar problems? And they will start, without it sometimes even are necessarily saying this to themselves this way, but they're going to operate this way. Okay, what are one or two ways of handling this problem? Because just to give you an example, in my workshops, I will ask people, have any of you ever faced a problem where your first thought is, I don't even know where to start? And most people, including myself, can think of a situation like that. And I say, well, imagine if almost every problem you faced, you felt that way. Well, then you're just going to be anxious. You're not going to be able to handle things well. So I will ask people, okay, think of a problem. Like, if I can use Mr. Butler. Here's Mr. Butler who said they just don't get it. And one of the things we looked at is he kept saying they don't get it. He kept losing employees who quit. And then one of the things I did is I said, let's look at this as a problem. You have people leaving on whatever. So let's look at it this way. Why don't they get it? Well, his first response was, he always resorted to this, it seemed at first. I almost laughed when he said, I didn't do a very good job hiring people. I hire people who don't know how to problem solve. I said, but let's look at it a different way. Let's assume that maybe you did hire people that could problem solve. Now let's look at it this way. What can you do so that they start to get it? And it may seem simple enough, but then one of the things we started going over is, how would you speak to someone who comes up with an idea that may not be the best idea, but that you want to build on that idea, that you want people to feel that you value them? And when I say this, people have, when I've used Mr. Butler as an example, people have said, didn't he realize this? But sometimes we have our blind spots in our mindset. So what we went over was, I said, view this as a problem. Think of different options. What else can you say? I mean, we actually did this rehearsal. And instead of saying, these are not very bright ideas, he started to say things like, you know, this is just a start. It may not work. Let's build on these ideas. And soon he had then people who were more willing to problem solve with him around the ideas. And I still remember the day he came in, Beth, and Mr. Butler, and he came in. He was all excited, and he said, guess what, Bob? They finally get it. And I asked him, well, why do you think they finally get it? And he said, well, because he finally got it. So one characteristic is, in all the work we do, we want people to be able to think of the problem, what it is, to think of possible solutions, to select the best solution, and then to see how it works, and if we have to go back and think of another solution. This ties...
Right.
Oh, good. I didn't know if you had a, because I was going to just bring up one other point. This ties to one of the most important characteristics of resilient people. And I emphasize this in all my workshops, and I tell clinicians and coaches, this you really have to build in. And it's something I said to Mr. Butler. Resilient people, when difficult situations arise, they never blame the situation. They don't blame other people, as Mr. Butler did, and they don't blame themselves. But you know what their mindset is? What is it I can do differently to change this situation? I mean, Stephen Covey, in his book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, said it somewhat differently. He said, we all have circles of concern. Effective people focus on their circles of influence, what they have influence over. Because there are so many unhappy people in this world who keep waiting for other people to change first without looking at what they can do differently. And this is not to blame, this is to empower us. So one of the main things, when Mr. Butler came in and said, they finally got it, it was my job to really help him to see that they got it because of his efforts. See, whenever I work with someone, I want them to see that they are the active agents in change here. And that in my books I say, and I really, emphasize, we are the authors of our own lives. There may be things we have no control over, but we have far more control over our reactions to things than we realize. And that's a part of a resilient mindset which has played a major role in my thinking.
That's really helpful. It sounds like the first two characteristics anyway, Mr. Butler demonstrated nicely, problems are there to be solved rather than burdened by, and then never blame the situation, people, or yourself. It also appears that the opportunity to grow, the problem is actually an opportunity to grow, was really exemplified in Mr. Butler's situation, where he then grew to the point that he said, well, I changed.
He could say it with a real smile. I mean, I love when people do. They said, "Okay, Bob, I get it." Now and that has to do, with the relationship. Which I didn't know if you had. There's another question because I wanted to get into. I wanted to get into another point very specifically about the relationship.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Should I get it?
That and other characteristics of the resilient
mindset. Okay, well, another characteristic of a resilient mindset, which again may seem obvious, is resilient people recognize that at times they may need assistance or help, and thus they are not hesitant to, ask for assistance and help. Now, what does this mean? One of the things it really means is for coaches is, to always, of course, we all do this, is to look at the relationship. And, there are those people we're going to coach who readily are there because they're there as coaches to hear what we have to say and learn from us. And then there are some who may not be as open or as welcoming. And I became very interested. Years ago, I read an article that talked about how those of us who are doing clinical work, and it also applies to coaches, should spend less time at first thinking about the lessons we want to teach and more time thinking about how we help the person feel. And one of the articles I read actually used the word, how we help the person feel welcome in our presence. So a resilient mindset is more open to learning, but if you're a coach, you have to start asking, how do I help people feel welcome in my presence? And, I've often said, I mean, others have said the same thing, that people don't care what you know until they first know you care. I realize that's exaggerating a little. You certainly want to make sure the person you're working with, the coach you're working with has the credentials, but people still want to know you care. They want to know they can learn from you. And I actually started asking people, how do you know someone cares? And, this too, coaches, I think, have to keep in mind that how do we know you care? Well, it was very interesting what people talked about. They wanted to know that the coach or clinician was the best way I could say it was accessible, that if they had a question, you know, that they could call in this particular person. They wanted to know that the person really listened very closely to them and validated, you know, things they said. Validation doesn't mean you agree. Interestingly enough, one thing that came up a lot was they wanted someone with a sense of humor. And we know that an important part of resilience is having a sense of humor, being able to both laugh at yourself, not put yourself down, but also that humor, as long as you're sure it's not sarcasm, is a way of really helping people to be less defensive and better able to hear certain messages. So even as I talk about a resilient mindset and like being a problem solver and feeling a sense of control, we must never lose sight that one of the key attributes of a resilient mindset is trust in other people, that you feel other people could be helpful, and then any of us has to really think about how do we create that welcoming attitude? How do we create that welcoming climate? And that's true in any relationship. And part of that, then, is one of the main skills I emphasize in all of my talks is the ability to be empathic. And we've all heard the word empathy, and in a simple way, it's the ability to put yourself inside the shoes of another person and see the world through their eyes. But when I've spoken with coaches, I say, here's an exercise you can use with your clients, but you should also do it within yourself. And that is the following. I always ask people to think about how would you like your clients to describe you? What words would you hope they use? Because every client has words to describe you. And then I say, what have you actually said or done so they're likely to use those words? And then to think about what words would they actually use, you know. And these are very important questions for me. If I'm giving a workshop, I'm thinking, what words do I hope the audience uses to describe me? What am I saying or doing so they're likely to use these words? What words would they actually use? And the same is true. If I'm doing therapy, what words do I hope, you know, my clients use to describe me? What am I doing so they're likely to use these words? And what words would they actually use? And then when we're actually coaching, these are questions. Let's say we're doing executive coaching. These are questions we should be asking clients also, you know, that the people who report to you, like getting back to Mr. Butler, he's on my mind today, I guess. I asked him, what words do you think, and this is before he started gaining more insight, what words do you think your employees would use to describe you? And he said, and it was almost funny, but in a sad way, he said, well, given the fact that I'm very direct, they may describe me, you know, as being abrasive and opinionated, and he goes on, and I'm sitting there saying, oh, this guy has more insight than I realize, and then he says, just like this, but of course, Bob, they would be wrong. Well, if you know, and one of the things I have to really say is, but if that's how they see you, that's where you have to start. And eventually, as he was able to say, you know, they finally get it. One of the things he also said is, I think they finally see me in a way that I want them to see me as someone who's there to be helpful and not judgmental or opinionated. So the whole issue of, you know, the relationship, a resilient mindset is one that you're trusting other people. And one of the ways we as coaches can help that is really by how empathic we are and how we validate, you know, different comments.
Right. Great. You're leading into something you write extensively about, which is the charismatic adult, the person nurturing the resilience, which we as coaches would be behaving as the charismatic adult. I'm wondering if you can share some of that work with the participants today.
Yeah, that is a very important concept. And again, just a little history. When researchers were studying people who had overcome adversity, you know, done relatively well in life, even given their difficulty. One of the questions they asked, which was a question very straightforward and one I loved, one of the questions they asked was this. They asked, what do you think were the most was the most important thing to help you to bounce back from adversity and be resilient? Some of these are people who as young adults have faced, you know, adversity and now are doing better. Some as children or adolescents. And it was fascinating, Beth. In every study that was done, bar none, the first answer was basically the same. They would say there was at least one person along the way who truly believed in me and stood by me. Even one person. Excuse me. And in 1988, one of my heroes in the field of psychology, he died a few years ago. His name was Julius Siegel. He was a psychologist in Washington, D.C. He wrote a 3-page article where he called that person a charismatic adult. He was talking about kids, but I've applied it to adults who are resilient as well. He said a charismatic adult, and whether one liked the term or not, his definition was, for me, just poetic. He said a charismatic adult is an adult from whom a child or adolescent gathers strength. Now, what I did, because I also work with adults, what I did was I said that applies to adults as well. And I actually started saying in my workshops, you know, that even as adults, we need charismatic adults in our life. And then where it really applied to me much more in terms of work with clients is, and it showed me that it's not just about kids, and it also showed me that any clinician, you know, any coach, anyone really assisting others would like to be seen that way. I'll tell you a quick story that I actually had someone who came to hear me more as a parent, but it was head of a financial institution. And he called me afterwards and he said, do you know, Bob, almost any financial advisor, every financial advisor would love to be seen as a charismatic adult by his or her clients, that they would like to be seen as a source of strength. And I said, well, that's interesting. You know, I hadn't quite put it that way before. And that led me to interview a number of financial advisors and eventually to write the book, The Charismatic Advisor. Because if I'm coaching someone, one of the things that I would be thinking about is the following. Does this person gather strength from me? Does this person see me as a source of strength? And what is it then that, what is it that I could say or do that will help them to see me that way? I think one of the things is, in any relationship like we're talking about, I think one of the main things is that,
I think you might need someone to mute, if you can, *6, please. Thank you.
Okay, sorry about that. anyway, what I started to say, and when I spoke to coaches and clinicians, financial advisors, is this. One of the things you might want to think about is, how can I serve as a charismatic adult in the life of my clients? And in the sense that Julia Siegel said, I want to be a source of strength from them. I want them to learn from me. I want them to be comfortable with me. And that got me more and more to say, you know, and it really got me into the whole issue of the resilient mindset. I started getting questions. People would actually say to me, okay, I want to be a charismatic adult. Sign me up. What do I actually say or do? And that led me to have to do more thinking about some of the things I talked about. Well, a charismatic adult is one who really knows they have to develop a certain relationship. They have to be empathic. A charismatic adult has to really make sure that in anything he or she says, that promoting a problem-solving attitude in people, that they have to be sure that they're promoting a sense of control, what I call personal control. People have to realize that although I'm there to assist them, what happens is I want them to more and more feel a sense of control of their own life. And there was another thing which I wanted to mention about a resilient mindset before I lose this train of thought that I also told coaches to think about is this. When we coach, I really think we have to look at the whole person. And I became very interested in a dynamic a few years ago that many people have told me in my work they were glad I brought this up. And it first started many years ago. I was writing a book about school climate, and I asked 1,500 adults, of all the memories you have of school, what is your favorite memory? Something that a teacher or administrator said or did that boosted your dignity and your motivation. Well, what fascinated me was this, that the number one positive memory I received was when you were asked to help out. So I got memories like, I remember when a teacher asked me to pass out the milk and straws. I remember when a teacher asked me to tutor a younger child. Now, some people may be wondering, listening to this, okay, but what does this have to do with coaching? Well, I started to feel that there's an inborn need in people to want to help. Right from birth, it's an inborn need. And then what happened was, when I was writing my book about resilience in adults, I realized something. It's not just kids. There's some wonderful research to show that people who are actively involved in helping others lead more resilient, successful lives. And this goes right into our elderly years. There's research to show elderly people who are actively involved in helping others, even if some of their other habits aren't great, they're still smoking or whatever, lead longer lives. So one of the things, and this is just maybe my bias, if one is doing coaching and helping people in their professional life, to me, the professional and personal lives really can blend together. I always try to look at in what way do they feel they're making a difference. And it doesn't mean just at the workplace. So I've worked with people who have been very, very happier because they do charitable work and they help out in ways. And one time I was reviewing companies that were the employees rated as being happier working for, and one of the things that kept coming up was those companies in which they gave employees an opportunity to help out in some way, you know, whatever, working in a charity, giving them actual time to help out, those employees were more productive and happier. So as a coach, I think one also has to think about, okay, what are some of the things that will lead this person to be more successful? Because if you feel more successful in your overall life, I feel you're going to be more successful and happier in the workplace as well. And I really wanted to emphasize that because I've been talking a great deal about that. And interestingly, so many of the emails I receive after my workshops especially focus on that. In my books, I call them contributory or charitable activities. And it's something I strongly advocate that has to be built into our work and how we help people as coaches to be more successful, and how our clients could, you know, if they're in in leadership positions, to build in opportunities for others to contribute.
Okay, so that's great. So you would add that in as one of the characteristics even of a resilient mindset, that someone who feels they're making a difference, holding that belief is part then of the resilient mindset from what I'm gathering you're saying, unless as coaches or charismatic adults, we need to feed the need that people have to help.
Yes, just very, very nicely, something you said is really attributive. When someone feels they are making a positive difference in this world, it's such an important feeling. It's part of a resilient mindset. A resilient person feels, because I'm on this earth, and not in the narcissistic way, but because I'm on this earth is a better place. And I cannot state that strongly enough. That was not something I thought about 20 years ago as much, but when I started to do some of the research and started to look at some of the research on resilience, I said, this is a very powerful feeling. And one other thing I'll mention, which may seem so obvious, but I really should mention this. A resilient person, how they deal with mistakes is the very essence of resilience also. So just to give you an example, what I've written about in my books and what research shows and is very obvious, someone with a resilient mindset feels that setbacks and mistakes are expected and accepted. It's just part of who we are. They're going to be setbacks. And they basically believe, their mindset is, I can learn from these mistakes. There are non-judgmental, non-accusatory people out there I can learn from. And they always are saying, what can I learn from this mistake? Sadly, there are a group of people, both children and adults I've worked with, who their mindset basically is every mistake is like, to use a metaphor I've used, is like a rock around their neck which weighs them down more and more and more. And soon they are sinking in quicksand. And think of it this way. If you keep making mistakes and have setbacks, but your mindset is, I cannot learn from these, then eventually you don't want to be humiliated anymore. So with some people, you know, some people will quit at things, they won't try at things, they'll blame other people. They'll basically use what I call maladaptive or counterproductive coping strategies. So one of the things I've built, you know, really built into my own work is when I'm working with someone and we're developing strategies, let's say with a Mr. Butler again, we're developing strategies. It's not unusual for me to say, this sounds very good, but what if it doesn't work? And the first time I told an audience that, people said, well, Bob, that's like a self-fulfilling prophecy for failure. And I smiled and I said, yeah, wait, I haven't finished. I will actually say, what if this doesn't work? What's backup plan A or B? Now, you don't have to do this all of the time, but I think as a coach, what we're helping people see is that we can do a lot of thinking. We can have what sounds like great strategies. But if they don't work, we, instead of feeling, see, another failure on my part, what we build in is really helping people see, but there can be backup plan A or B. And, you know, I really learn a lot from the feedback I get, like we all should. And one of the things that a number of people over the years have told me is, I'm glad you brought up, what if it doesn't work? Now, because sometimes it's that it worked, but not as effectively as people thought. Sometimes it didn't work. And if it works, then great. We don't need to use a backup plan. But I really think that we have to prepare people for the fact that some things will not work, but it's not a self-fulfilling prophecy for failure. Rather, it's an opportunity to look at what do we learn from this and what's a possible other strategy or option we can use. And, again, based on the feedback I got, this was something that I had years ago I did not incorporate into my work, and much I do so much more now. And I think it's a way of just really developing a resilient mindset by saying, okay, be prepared for some things not working as effectively as others.
Right, and then the key point you mentioned, mistakes are opportunities to grow. So if it doesn't work effectively, we'll use that as an opportunity to grow. And leaping off of the need that you were mentioning, the human needs that we have, feeding the need to want to help, maybe we can go forward in a discussion on intrinsic motivation and Dacey's model with our needs, how this plays into your work and resilient mindset.
Oh, yeah. Well, I became very interested. You know, with all these ideas we're talking about, one of the things that really dovetailed with it, over the years I've become fascinated by the whole issue of motivation. It didn't matter what group I spoke with, questions of motivation came up. If it was a parent's group, how do I motivate my child to do his or her homework? Coaching my sons in sports, and when I spoke to youth coaches, how do I motivate kids to practice? And then, you know, in the business, how do I motivate my staff to do this? In education, how do I motivate students? You know, so it kept coming up. And I had to ask a question that I think every coach and clinician really should ask, and that is, what is your theory of motivation? And I became very, very interested years ago in one theory that I felt really captured what we call intrinsic motivation and really went along with the resilience model. And that was the work of Edward Deci and then a colleague of his, Richard Ryan, at the University of Rochester in New York. And they were really highlighted in one of my favorite books on motivation, Daniel Pink's book called Drive, where he really reviews theories of motivation. And what basically DC said, and I just found it so applicable to my work and something also that could be applied, I quote, in the real world. It wasn't just this theory that couldn't be applied as easily. Basically, DC said, and it's similar to the work of William Glasser, who wrote Reality Therapy, DC basically says this: anyone who comes into our office or in our workplace, there are certain needs people have. And when a leader or an organization, you know, meets these needs in a systematic way, you can predict almost in advance people are going to be more motivated to work with you. They're going to be more cooperative, more willing to participate with you. And the words I coined to describe it in a number of my writings is, we want to create motivating environments where everyone really wants to work together. So if you're a physician, you want your patient to work with you. If you're a Mr. Butler, you want a motivating environment where your employees are working closely with you. In a school, you want students, if you're a teacher, to work closely with you. So it was in every situation. And then he said there were three basic needs, which you'll see really tied to some of the points I made before, that when I go in and consult to different groups or different organizations or even in a one-to-one coaching or clinical situation, I'm aware of. He says these are the three needs that if you systematically meet these needs, you're going to have a much better chance of people wanting to work with you and learn from you and collaborate with you. And I remember when I was reading this, I said, oh, my, what are these three needs? I didn't know, you know, what they were. And then when I read them, I said, this is basic humanity, if you will. This, you know, you could almost see it feels right. And so you'll see how it ties to a resilient mindset. This is what I loved about the work when I was doing it, how it wasn't like I needed 20 theories of resilience and 20 theories of motivation, how they really overlapped. So one of the needs, he said, is the need to belong and feel connected. And before, that's when I talked about a resilient mindset, you feel people are accessible. So I started really asking, and I think this is an important question, whether it was in the business world, whether it was in schools, I started asking this, what do you think your students would say or your employees would say helps them to feel welcome when they each day? You know, what gives them a sense of belonging here? Because belongingness is a very, very powerful feeling. And recently I gave a workshop where I said, you know, I travel a lot. I see it in hotels where I stay. I go in, and there are some hotels, you know, and most nowadays, where the person at the desk will say, Dr. Brooks, I hope you had a good trip, and, you know, they're very nice, and if there's anything we can do, and I'll pass by an hour later, and how are you doing, Dr. Brooks, and they'll call up to your room, is there anything, you know, we can do? And then, Beth, there are some hotels I've gone into where I feel after like a minute saying to the person, do you realize you're in a service industry? Just to let them know that it's just the way, you know, I don't feel very welcome. So I think any coach has to say, how do I help people feel welcome here? And really to keep that in mind. And then if you're coaching, you know, someone in healthcare, you're coaching someone in a leadership position, I raise that question. How do you think people feel welcome in your setting? So one of the things is, okay, belong and welcome. And one I found, again, one of the things that you feel, that people feel you're accessible within reason, the sense of humor, that, you know, that you remember things that said the week before. I mean, that's really very important. And I've actually said sometimes, and it's interesting to me that people have picked up on, I said, you know, I thought, and it has to be genuine, you can't just fake it, but say, you know, I thought a lot about the questions you brought up last week. And people really like to know you're thinking about them. And the small little things on that, but it's a very, very important kind of thing. The second need for motivation, which I tell coaches, think about this in terms of how you relate to your client and how they relate to others, also ties to that issue of personal control and problem solving. DC calls it self-determination and autonomy. And what basically it means by this is, do people feel they are active participants in the process? Do they feel they have some choices, that they can make some, you know, that they are making decisions? This is why when I say to Mr. Butler, why did your workers get it? And he said, well, I finally got it. I want him to have that sense of ownership. You know, I always say if anyone finishes, you know, say, let's say as a therapist, anyone finishes therapy with me and says, the only reason that they succeeded was because I'm a great therapist. I haven't done my job. I want them to feel Bob Brooks was helpful as a coach, or I was helpful, you know, as a therapist. But I want them to feel that much of their success was based on their own resources. I want them to feel they have some choice. And that's why in problem solving, I love people to say, let's think of different options. And I want, the more it comes from them, the more motivated they are going to be. And then, the most importantly also is, then in the future, they're going to feel they have within themselves the ability to make these choices and decisions. And because they've, in my office and outside the office, they have already practiced some of these skills. Just to give you, by the way, it may seem like, to me, it was almost a funny example, but it was a very powerful one. Edward Deci did research where they went into a high school, and they gave one group of high school students a choice. They said you could do homework A or B, basically. Basically, they were variations of a theme. Another group in the same high school of students, they weren't given a choice of A or B. They were told, here's your homework. And even though I believe strongly in this, I said, I wonder if they got any, you know, real significant results. Well, the kids who were given a choice of A or B did more homework, did it more effectively than the kids who were not given a choice. And interestingly, I don't know if you want to call it a side effect, they judged the teachers to be more concerned and caring about their learning because they were given a choice. Well, the same principles apply in the business world. When, again, I've looked at businesses that are more successful, invariably the people who work there feel that their voice is being heard, that people really listen to what they have to say. And so that's a second dimension. So we have the need to belong, and we have the need for self-determination and autonomy. And the third need, also I loved it, the third need is the need to feel competent. And one of the reasons I love the word is about 31 or 2 years ago, I started using a metaphor. I started saying that all people, and this was really the roots of the strength-based model, even though people may have problems, every person has what I called islands of competence. It was just a metaphor I started to use. And little did I know it was going to change my entire approach to when I interacted, you know, in my work. And I always feel very strongly, and coaches, I think, do this very naturally, but I think when we work with someone, we should pose questions like, what do you enjoy doing? What do you think you do that's pretty good? What are your strengths? Because so many times it's easy to focus on what people aren't doing well because we see our jobs as, or responsibilities as helping them, you know, to overcome difficulties. But I think if we're ever to touch the heart, soul, and spirit of other people, we have to look at their strengths. What do they like? And I think it's important in coaching also, when we work with people in healthcare and leadership positions, I ask them, could you, if you put down everyone who works for you, or could you put down with your patients, do you know what that person would say his or her strengths are, what their islands of competence are, and how are they using it? So one man I saw, he wasn't very happy at work, but he felt things could not change that much at work, and it was well paying, and he said it's not something I could just leave the job. But I said to him, well, what do you see as your strengths? What are your interests? And he said to me, he always liked to do carpentry, but he really hasn't done it as much. He had a couple of kids at home, and he was busy. But then he ended up doing, and it was to have a positive impact at work too, because he came to work happier. He started building like furniture for his kids, and he enlisted them, even though they were young, to do little things. So now it may seem like a simple example, but by finding out his islands of competence And by having him start engaging in these islands of competence, and he also involved his kids, he felt much more content even going to work. He felt at least he was spending some time on things that brought him actually greater enjoyment than what he was experiencing at work. So whenever I consult somewhere, whenever I go into an organization, I'm always looking, is the need to belong and feel welcome here? Is the need for self-determination or autonomy being met? And do people really focus on strengths here? Do they appreciate strengths? Do they know what strengths are? And I started saying, if you can answer those questions as a coach, then what you're going to do is you're going to have someone who's going to be much more motivated to work with you, and they're going to learn those skills from you so they could use it with other people who they are working with.
That's great. Thank you for that summary. That was wonderful. It's been an hour now, and we did promise to open up the discussion to the participants. I'd like to take this opportunity to do so. If anyone has a question that they'd like to pose to Dr. Brooks on resilience, resilient mindset, charismatic adults, islands of competence, intrinsic motivation, please this opportunity to pick his brain.
Beth, this is Laurel.
Yes.
Pound six will unmute the callers. Pound
okay,
six.
And I'll push pound six now. Okay.
No. They need to push pound six.
Oh, great. So you need to pound six yourself to ask your question.
Yeah.
So we can hear you.
I hear
Hello?
Some.
Yep.
Hello.
Hello.
Do you have a question?
Hello. This is Zareen. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. What's your name, though? I
Zareen Arawa.
Okay.
And I'm wondering how you have found you cultivate or find resilience in people of different cultures and how that differs. And whether you have any insights on that.
Well, that is a wonder. Oh, I'm sorry, I interrupted. Did I interrupt? Was there more to the question?
No, please go ahead. I just finished. Somebody else said something.
Oh, okay. Well, that is a wonderful question. Actually, I think more research has to be done in terms of cultural factors. Most of my work has, although I've spoken in different countries, and when I've spoken to people about resilience, the characteristics that I mention, they certainly seem to fit in different cultures. But what your question raises question for me. As I went over the characteristics, I didn't know if your question was based on different cultures that you've seen. Would those characteristics you feel fit, or would they be very different? And then it might be easier for me to answer, on that question.
Actually, I think that the three characteristics, not the characteristics, but the three needs that you mentioned,
yes,
are universal. But how you go about helping people feel that way would be different in different cultures.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and I probably, I could easily say that would, probably be true. Where I've gotten some questions is, on self-determination and autonomy, some people have said, well, in some cultures, that may be seen as, someone brought up once this, that may be seen, if you're looking at self-determination, and autonomy, that may be seen as you just want to work by yourself, or one person actually said, isn't that narcissistic, you just want to work by yourself? But I said, you have to take the three needs together. having your own ideas, having choices, does not mean that you cannot work very successfully as a team. As a matter of fact, I'm a firm believer you should. And I said that gets to the whole issue of really belonging, you know, the sense of belonging and belonging to a team. So I agree with you. And even how then one might, you know, speak to other people would certainly be very important. So I think your point is very well taken. At the psychiatric hospital where I work, you know, we had a whole seminar on cultural differences and diversity and speaking, you know, with people and how they hear our messages. And what I would say is then, if the themes I went over are more universal, as you said, then of course it would be incumbent on us, it would be important for all of us to say, okay, how do I say this? You know, how do I welcome people? You know, what do I say that I might want to say differently? But I do think they're universal themes. I think even when one looks at a resilient mindset, feeling comfortable with, you know, with other people, feeling that you do have some sense of what I call personal control or make a difference and contributing and making a difference in the world and being a good problem solver, these I would guess would, you know, also be universal themes, and not just applicable to, where most of my work has taken place in Massachusetts or the United States.
I think as you said, the major question is around determination and autonomy, because in many cultures, direction and hierarchy are respected much more. So it brings us to a much more basic cultural question of, are these basic human needs, or are there needs that are culturally determined? Determination and autonomy, and I'm sure we can't solve that here, but I just wanted to raise it.
Thank you. You could write a book about that question. Because in one of my books, I talk about some of the research, but where there is this almost inborn need to feel you have some say, but if you also grow up in a culture where that maybe is not as valued, then it's a very interesting question. What happens there? Because, you know, I could easily say, based on my experience, people do want to feel they have a say, but if you're growing up in a more hierarchical society, by the way, the need may still be there. But it's not as expressed. So maybe someday I'll pick up a book that you've written about that question.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the question.
Thank you. Hello?
Is there someone else on?
Hello? Can you hear me? This is Anne speaking.
Yes, I can. Did you say Anne?
Yes, Dr. Brooks. I wasn't sure she could hear me.
I'm sorry, did you say your name was Anne?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, I just want to make sure. It's always tough when you're, you know, you don't see people, so you're not sure who's talking to whom.
Right. I really loved your talk, and one point that
Thank
really
you.
Resonated for me was holding a space of welcoming another, because what really happened for me when I heard that, I felt like that when you hold that space for another person, they can transform themselves. And so I just want to say thank you about that. And my question is about, you mentioned the 3 points for motivation, and would you, I don't know, I think feeling that I can make progress as a human being is a motivator as well. Would you not say that that could be a 4th point on the list of motivators?
Yes, probably, because I said it quickly, one could put it as a 4th point easily. Some people have put as another point, although I've incorporated it in, and then I'll get to your question. Some people have said, isn't it a motivator, because I mentioned it under resilience, that if you feel you're making a positive difference in the world, And I say mm-hmm. yes as well. What you brought up is, in my more in my writings, under self-determination and autonomy is the feeling of that you have some say and can progress. So what you're bringing up is very important. I've included it often under that. But that's Deasy's model. But, you know, in Pink's book, he expanded on Deasy's model. He was the one who said another motivation is when you feel that you are making a difference in the world. And I've typically put that under feeling competent. So I think probably if we were to do some brainstorming, we could add others that I've basically incorporated. But when I've talked about Pink's book Drive and how he described DC's model, I said he actually added something that I've included under competent and yet is something I've talked a lot about, that people will be more motivated when they feel what they are doing is making a positive difference in the lives of others. So your point is very well taken. I've broken it. I've included it, but probably it could be very helpful to people to also think about each of those particular three needs or whatever you want to call them. They have subparts. That may not be subparts, actually, on that. And I just want to get back to the welcoming. I'm glad you picked up on that because, for me, the relationship is everything. You know, sometimes in my workshops, people will say, just give me strategies, or in my work, coaching work or whatever, just give me strategies. And I'll always say, you know, the first strategy is to make sure you develop a relationship where this person is going to be most likely to want to learn from you, you know, and to hear you. What good is a strategy if a person is sitting with you and they feel you really don't care that much about them or you're not very welcoming? And so I'm so glad you put, and you've worded it so nicely. I mean, it's that we want to be in that environment. We could all think of, I'm sure, classes we've taken or whatever where we learn much more effectively when we feel a welcoming quality in that class that's non-judgmental, non-accusatory, and we just feel, whatever words we want to use, safe, secure, where you feel you could say almost anything. So I really want to underline what you had brought up there, because for me, again, the relationship is everything else is powered by the relationship. So
thank you so much for that response.
Thank you.
My name's Barbara, and I have a
question.
Hello? I heard two voices.
Hello?
I heard Barbara. Did I hear Barbara?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Very loud and clear, Barbara.
First of all, I want to say I'm new to teleconferencing on something like this, and I think you're doing a phenomenal job at being welcoming. And I think
thank you.
That's tricky over the phone. I'm a psychiatrist, and my welcoming comes when someone comes in my office. And I've done phone sessions with people after I know them, so they have an experience of me as welcoming. But just to start cold on the phone, I think is hard. I think you're doing a great job.
Thank you. The main reason I was willing to even do this was because I said, because Beth was at least willing to have a little dialogue with me. It's really, I'm laughing because it's really weird to be speaking into a phone and trying to imagine people's responses. So thank you, Barbara, for that comment. You just made me feel much more at ease. Well, thank you.
Because I'm not somebody that would typically call in, and I thought, well, I do like it because you're very welcoming. So thank you.
Thank you.
So let me ask a question about a couple of clients that I have. And I got drawn to the Coaching Institute because I felt like I was doing that in psychiatry, that I would do the initial diagnosis and problem solving, but that my strength and why people came back to me was because we would be focusing on their strength and moving forward. So the coaching, I'm trying to learn more about and how to incorporate it into a psychiatric practice. And it's been great. What do you do when, and I have a number of healthcare professionals in my practice, including other therapists, how do you help someone who feels like they're having a failure in one part of their life? Like someone, I have a marriage and family therapist whose two kids are both having drug problems.
Mm-hmm.
And she's feeling like a failure and trying to separate out being authentic in her work with also her own dismay right now. How do you coach someone like that?
Yeah. Okay. I was immediately going to respond. And my oldest son's very successful today, but when he was in the 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th grades, he did no work in school. And you have to understand, I was lecturing all over the country on how to motivate students. All of his teachers had taken my workshop on motivating students. And I still remember when I got a warning slip with, from about him where I was quoted on the warning slip. So I could totally appreciate that. And it's not easy because I, you know what I was feeling? Here I am helping all these families with kids who supposedly are not motivated. And, there was one of his counselor at school was very helpful to me. He said, you know, Bob, look at the whole picture. I mean, this is what I always said to people, you know, look at the whole picture. And part of it is I became so focused, Barbara, on his not doing his homework. But in fact, he was successful in many other areas. So one of the things I try to look at is he was president of the youth group in our town. For someone who was not, who got a warning slip on computer programming, he developed two computer programs I used with kids with learning problems. But of course, I was upset because he wasn't getting grades for this. You know, and so one of the things I realized is this, and it gets to, in the particular example, I know there are many others. I often have said, you know, often we take too much credit for our kids' success and too much blame for our kids' failures. And it doesn't mean we are not a good therapist if our own children have problems or, you know, if there are different problems there. What I try to say to people in that situation is, one, I'm very empathic, having gone through it, and my son and I have a great relation today. He's very successful. But what I try, first of all, I found that just being empathic and just, you know, validating that it is very frustrating, and I'm sure that is something that you do. And then I also, what I did in my own life, I said, okay, what can I learn from this? And one of the things that really helped me was this. Before Richard's behavior like this, I would have thought if a parent just followed all the things I said about motivation, they would have a kid who was motivated. Well, Rich was very motivated, just not to do his homework or school. So I think that it's very important for people to look at, you know, I started saying, you know what I learned from this? Every person has their own path in life. And we do have to learn from it. We may not have caused a problem, but we also have to look at how we relate to it. And remember before when I said personal control, I am convinced I had no control over Richard's grades. You know what I had control over? When I came home every day saying the first thing, instead of saying I love you, instead I would ask that famous question, many, did you do your homework? Did you do your homework? Did you do your homework on that? So one of the things I think one could help with is what can we learn from this? That, you know, why people go down different paths, there are many different reasons, you know. And really, what I found was very helpful was when, and it was his counselors at school and one of the teachers who just were very empathic. They said, we know that this is upsetting to you. We know this. And they made a point of really trying to let me also think about some of the positive things and the positive things I had done. And they weren't really doing therapy with me. I thought it was closer to probably coaching, you know, there.
Yeah.
And it was very helpful in that regard. So I, in looking at that experience, said they were empathic. They understood what I was feeling. And they really, and what the sense I started making out of it is, because see, I started feeling I have no control over Richard's grades. I have control over my reaction and what I can learn from this. And again, it wasn't easy. I mean, when he finally started getting good grades as a senior, I can't tell you the sense of relief. Finally, I didn't mind going up to open school night and, you know, meeting with the teachers. But it's, you know, we're all human. And over the years, I've worked with so many psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, and other healthcare providers, families, and whatever. And you realize we're all in this together. We can learn from it. And I'm not saying any of this is easy. It can be very painful. I mean, I've worked with mental health professionals where there's been a suicide in the family. And the same thing. Why didn't I see this boy? And I think just being there, it could be so, so helpful to them. But I love your question, having lived it. And And hopefully Rich will never write a book called Daddy Dearest. You know.
Well,
so,
one thing I can tie in a circle from what you said earlier is two things. The counselors identified in you, the guidance counselors, your islands of confidence, other than, you know, if you weren't having success and having him get good grades right now, but you had islands of confidence as a parent. You had a good kid. And then it sounds like you learned to look at your son's islands of confidence. You know, he's not really great, but look at what a kid I have. You know, he's doing this and he's doing that. We had islands of confidence. Identifying that really is a helpful notion.
Well, you did a lovely job of summarizing, you know, those points, and probably there are many more, but you can't see it, of course, because we're talking about this over the phone, but I'm smiling as you say that because your question brought up memories from a number of years ago, and it's a very important question. I certainly have faced it a lot in my work. So thank you for calling in.
Hi, this is Michael from Barcelona. Do you have time for one more question?
I'm sorry, Michael, did you say? I'm sorry, I missed
Michael,
your name.
Yeah.
And but where are you? You said from?
Michael Brandenburg, calling in from Barcelona, Spain.
Barcelona. I thought you, I'm sorry. My wife and I had a lovely vacation there a couple years ago. I love your city. So, but you didn't call about my saying that. So, okay. I thought you said Buffalo, New York at first. So, okay. And the question, Michael.
Okay. The question, Bob, is about, you mentioned this concept of a charismatic person. Is there, I'm really looking forward to get one example of your books. You have charismatic advisor to read it. Right now, question, is there one or two specific advices that you can give us to how to help a person to become a charismatic person?
Oh, wow. We could spend hours on this. But, again, that's the question I often get. I want to be a charismatic, you know, this charismatic person. What do I say or do? And there's several, I know it's posted on the McLean, I think on this website, the coaching website, but in my writings, I talk about things like empathy that, you know, which I talked about, that it's, again, it gets to the relationship. People have to feel that you really are trying to understand them and not judging or accusing them. And I realize these are just words. I mean, in longer workshops, I give, you know, actual examples of that. And a key issue when I talk about empathic communication is when people bring certain things up, again, how do we validate these things? Because validation doesn't mean you agree on that. Another thing about a charismatic adult is charismatic adults, and I'm calling it adult because that's what Siegel called it, but it, you know, my book, I called it a charismatic advisor. While they know that we're all going to have problems, and this is one of the things I mentioned, it's very important, again, this is the feedback I've gotten, to ask about what are your, you know, to think about what are the person's strengths. Like with the last caller, when I lost sight that my son had many strengths because he wasn't getting good, you know, he was getting warning slips because he wasn't doing his homework on that. So building in even to one's interviews or, you know, the dialogue with the other person, what do you see as your strengths? What do you see as your interests? Is a very important thing, which I must tell you, in the beginning of my career, I did not ask as much, especially trained as a clinical psychologist. I was like, I got to find out what the problems are so I could, not that I worded it this way, fix it. So looking at the strengths. And the other thing I think that's very important as you're discussing things with someone, and again, it gets to something I said before, but I found that people really can start to relate to it, has to do with helping them feel some sense of this, what I call in my writings, personal control, that you're really very respectful and you're asking them for opinions. And I don't worry, you know, at the beginning, sometimes I would say, well, what do you think, or what do you think will help? And sometimes the initial response would be, I don't know. And I learned then to say, well, I know right now you don't know. See, this gets to empathy. I know right now you don't know, but this is something maybe we could work on to figure out a different solution to this. And then I'll often say, is this something you would like to work on? So I'm putting it back on them. So your question could be one we could spend, you know, hours on, because it's something I've really tried to, I've struggled with, you know, what makes for a charismatic advisor. And with different people, it may be different things, but there's that whole issue of welcoming, being empathic, really looking at people's strengths, not just what's wrong with them, and really helping them to see that they are, as I say in one of my books, the authors of their own lives. And we're going to help them, even though we're there to help, we want them to walk away from the situation feeling that they on their own can better handle the different challenges they face. So I hope that it's a quick summary, but I hope it gives you some sense of the thinking I do about it.
Well, thank you so much. Actually, in this 4 minutes, you have set in my head a very motivating environment for further thinking. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And I see you using some words I love. Thank you.
Bob, this is Laurel Doggett with the Institute of Coaching. I just want to say, for those of you on the line, we do have the masterclass that Bob and Beth wrote. It is in the masterclass section when you log in under Positive Psychology. There are some articles on Charismatic Advisor, Emotional Health and Well-Being. We also have the full video keynote from Bob's presentation at the Coaching and Leadership Conference, I think in 2011, if I recall correctly.
Right. Yes.
So there are lots of generous materials that generously have been donated to build this masterclass from you, Bob. So we're so appreciative.
And thank you for having me. I really, this was a lot of fun.